This is Philosophy versus Improv, where two sages try to teach each other a thing or two, and maybe you, the audience, get something out of it as well.
This is Mark Linsenmeyer giving you a little dose of philosophy today.
And this is Mary Hines bringing the improvisational energy. And we are joined by...
Me? Oh, Elijah Dan. Yes.
You!
Thank you.
And an actual philosophy professor in Canada. Are you still there or are you retired from there? Where?
Well, I'm just teaching. I wanted to keep my foot in the door teaching because it's really the lifeblood. I love teaching. I've taught for 35 years or so. The nice thing about it is I'm teaching at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. It's for the seniors department, and those are specifically for people who are 55 years or older. You can be younger, and the nice thing about it is they let me teach whatever I want to teach. My students love it, and over the years, I've taught some great courses that I've been able to tailor for myself, and there's been great interest in it. I just finished teaching a course on critical thinking, but it wasn't just critical thinking. I thought we need something a little bit more robust these days, so the course was entitled A Guide to Critical Thinking in an Age of Conspiracies, Ideology, and Assorted Woo-Woo. And the registration was filled the first day, and they want me to teach it again in a couple more months. So, yeah, we had a lot of fun. So I like to keep my courses as current as possible and as topical as possible.
And I see your list of books that you started writing your dissertation on Richard Rorty, but mostly have had fairly publicly accessible sorts of things, an introduction to philosophy, but then a lot of stuff about God and ethics, and this one that you're promoting now, Unbelieving God, A Skeptic's Guide. Do you want to say a little about what you're trying to accomplish with the book?
At the end of 2008 or 9, I wrote this book, God in the Public Square. And the book that I just published was actually part of that book, but my editor said, we can't do the whole thing. It's too big a book, so let's cut it in half. And so we cut it in half, and we published God in the Public Square. And then, you know what? As I explain in my Skeptics book, that I kind of forgot about it. I forgot about everything was pretty busy in life, and I forgot about it up until I was teaching a course here in town at a university, and I was teaching a course in the philosophy of religion, and I was looking for a good textbook, and I couldn't find one. And then I realized, you know, everything I want to talk about in this course, I wrote about. And so I dug out that book out of my computer, and there it was. But I had to re-edit it because almost 10 years had passed, and a few elections had taken place. And I also found myself in the place of no longer being a religious believer. I have spent pretty well most of my adult life thinking about religion, thinking about arguments pro and con. I did both of my dissertations. I did a PhD in philosophy, but I also did a PhD in theology at the University of Strasbourg in France. And both were in the philosophy of religion. And so I've been thinking about these arguments back and forth for a long time. And I realized that I was no longer a religious believer, even though over the years I'd been shedding my evangelical, then liberal, and then progressive Christian beliefs, till I just realized there was nothing left. And maybe because of Richard Rorty, I've thought for years that the job of a philosopher is perhaps to do what Dewey thought, and that is to address the problems of humanity instead of some of the more esoteric things our colleagues do. I know by experience, I know by the courses I teach at my university, I know by just charting things online that there's a deep, deep, deep interest in the epistemology of religious belief. And there's people like Alex O'Connor and, you know, the old school people like Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins certainly have shown that there is a very, very deep interest in these issues. And yet so very little of it is offered in our universities sometimes. And to make these ideas accessible to the average individual has always been my goal. And that's what I tried to do in this book. I looked at the more contemporary, let's say, the more typical arguments you'll get for religious belief in our day. I do look at the old arguments from Anselm and Aquinas. Mm-hmm. And those are very interesting in their own right. But I think, again, when you have somebody come to your door and now that you can talk about your faith at work, which I kind of think, hey, you know, as long as you do it in a nice way and people can do it in a professional way, why not? And my kind of thought is, if you want to do that at work, then get my book, look at the arguments and your friend who wants
the handbook on how to talk about it at work.
Well, that would be a good one too, but that would be a good appendix. Absolutely.
Like an accompanying pamphlet. Like you can even approach it from a comedic standpoint is like how to talk about religion at work.
Oh, absolutely, Mary. And I think, you know, I think it's a wonderful thing to, you know, when people talk to me about their faith, I just think about the arguments that I've written out in that book. And usually they're going to appeal to one of those arguments. And I think if your coworker comes up and says, hey, Bob, let's go out for coffee for lunch. I'm going to tell you about my faith. Bob should say, well, great. I'm just going to read this book really quickly. And
may I bring the pamphlet with me?
Yeah.
Elijah, I'm curious, what happened or what caused you to no longer be a religious believer? I'm sure it's probably not one thing, but like a string of things. But I'm curious about the origin that launched that switch in religious belief for you.
Well, the thing is, it's been a long journey. I was raised in a very conservative Christian evangelical home in Alberta, although evangelical in the 60s and 70s meant something different than it does today. But we were very conservative family. And Alberta in Canada is a very conservative province. I went to Bible college, and that's where I really got into thinking about my faith as a junior philosopher. And then I went on to other institutions. All along, I was studying my faith, but during that time, Mary, I was shedding some of the more conservative values or conservative theology I had. Because when I studied in my Bible college in Saskatchewan, we had professors who were creationists. So we had professors who believed that the world was maybe 10,000 years old, but even if it wasn't, Adam and Eve were actual people and dinosaurs walked with humans. So it was a matter of, I think, over the years when I decided to go to university, public university, and started to learn more about science and to be more critically minded, the science got better in my mind. And when I looked at the Bible, there were just some things I in my own faith, I thought, you know, if God does exist, this God understands where I'm at right now with the fact that I can't adjudicate that. But, you know, religious believers, we have a really good knack at cognitive dissonance. That is, we can really compartmentalize beliefs. If there's a bit of science, you know, on here and our religious belief, we have a way of just kind of working it out or just leaving it maybe as what epistemologists call as an epistemic dangler. It's just hanging around out there. It's just there, you know.
An epistemic dangler. I love that. Sounds like a fishing term. Oh, yeah, the epistemic danglers are really biting out on the lake there, Ron.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, they just happily exist in our worldview. Because when you are a religious believer, you can't give up too much. If you start to give up too much, then it's very hard to know how to stop it. But you do have to give up some. And if you don't, there's other problems. And I was always convinced as a religious believer that if God exists, then God doesn't mind that I'm thinking about these issues.
I love that.
It's a great exit hatch, right? God gave us reason. We're supposed to question things.
Come let us reason together.
I think that's an interesting, I love what you said about shedding, which, you know, in improvisation, one of the core foundations of like, how do you actually improvise? And one of the ways is like, if this is true, then what else is true? So when you say shedding, my brain goes to exfoliating. And the act of shedding and the act of exfoliating are active processes to remove, you know, cells in terms of that exfoliating language, that removing things that no longer serve and allowing you to reshape and restructure. And then my next thought goes is that in order to be in a place where you're able to shed and exfoliate, that requires safety.
Yes.
To be able to dive down into those things, hold them up, look at them. Do I really agree that I am so humble, meek, and lesser than my God? Or does that never taste right to me?
I love that metaphor because it's exactly what you do.
It started from you, sometimes. Elijah. You inspired it. I yes anded you. So thank you.
Well, it's a neurological exfoliation kind of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But when you are in a very powerful, all-encompassing worldview, there's more at work than just belief. Right? The psychology, I'm getting into the psychology of belief more and more these days. And I find that it's really fascinating because when somebody has a belief, let's stay to the religious beliefs, it's more than just 1 + 1 = 2. There's more at stake for that person. There's a sense of identity. Their family is tied into it. Their community is tied into it. There's so much psychologically that is bound up in that. So I use the example with my students. There's some arguments for the existence of God that I present to my students in class. And some of my students are religious believers, but they do understand the problems of some arguments. But when I talk to a religious believer, which I love to do, and I present to them the same problem against their argument, they look at me and they just, there's nothing, I'm just not penetrating the mind, so to speak. It's a psychological issue at work there. But I fight very hard against the belief that facts don't change minds. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes, you know, it's a song that changed our minds or a poem that changes our mind. But if facts don't change our minds, I wouldn't be here. I mean, the world history wouldn't be the way that it is. Universities wouldn't be. Facts do change minds. And by the way, if facts don't change minds, then it seems to be a contradiction if you're trying to argue that point with me using facts. If facts don't change minds, then what are you doing right now trying to argue with me?
Yeah, then your point is moot. Then
what are you gonna, yeah, you're going to do performative dance to communicate what you're trying to explain
I'd
to me?
I'd actually love to, and I do have something prepared. No, I'm just kidding.
I'd love to see that. That'd be very interesting. I'd love to see that. Yeah, that's kind of the... So, yes, I do acknowledge that there's more at work than just brute facts, but facts do change people's minds very often, and I think we need to stick to the facts as well, right?
My name's Mary Catherine Hines. I don't know how much more Irish Catholic one can get, and I was raised in a very strict Catholic household, you know, with my grandmother with her matriarchal line being like saying, and I quote, "If you don't go to church every Sunday, you're going to hell." So that my sweet, wonderful father, like that is how he was raised as well. My mom was not religious, but she loved my father. So she converted to, Catholicism for him. And I was raised under a pretty strict Catholic structure, and I sang in the choir and I was the cantor. And I really loved that because to me, that was a really beautiful. So I was raised under this structure. And then because I had the safety and support of my parents in the privacy of my room, I was reading books on world religion, Buddhism, Taoism. I was starting to question things, but I still enjoyed going to church because to me, God gave me the gift of my voice and singing is a beautiful form of prayer. And I love Palestrina and Bach, and it's just such like beautiful music. And so then, you know, I had to go to church every Sunday or hell, right? Like you do. And then when I hit like 15 or so, I remember my parents saying to my sister and I, "You don't need to go to church anymore unless you want to."
Wow.
And so, which I thought it was such a beautiful gift because like while I'm in church and some of these prayers are, you're saying the prayers, like we're going through the song and dance, if you will, I would just like leave out certain parts of the prayer that just like didn't feel right to me. Like, you know, I'm not saying that part of the creed because I don't agree with that. So I still went to church because I really enjoyed the community, but internally I was restructuring how I resonated with the faith. And now I consider myself an amalgam of lots of different ideologies of religions, but I feel like I have a strong spiritual core, but it's been through my own definition and shaping.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good story. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Just to finish off, what changed my mind ultimately my son was born and I was reminded of the story of Adam and Eve. And I just couldn't believe it anymore. I just couldn't. And the problem in the story of Adam and Eve, you know, with God tempting them, I thought my son, you know, if I said to my son, I'm going to test him now. I'm going to say, son, eat whatever you want in the fridge. I'm taking off for a minute or two, but don't touch those blueberries. Yeah, my son at year and a half, he would just, the first thing he would do is he'd go for the blueberries.
Of course.
Now, do I come around the corner and go into an unholy tantrum of epic proportion, you know? And then I, you know, Hitchens used to talk about, you know, man-made religion. And I thought, yeah, if God does exist, he can't have that kind of temperament, a temperament of, prehistoric. This is where I appreciate fundamentalists who say, well, Adam and Eve were actual human beings and they were our first parents. Okay, you know, let's go from there. But I kind of appreciate that. It's when the more liberal-minded people say, well, Adam and Eve, it's just a metaphor. Well, what's it a metaphor for? And not only that, we have a problem as a theologian, even though I'm not a believer anymore, I'm still a theologian. I have read the Bible dozens of times. I know what the Bible says. And Paul's very explicit in the New Testament says, through one man's sin, death entered into the world. He was talking about Adam and Eve. So for Paul, he believed, you know, which is understandable, you know, first century Palestine, he believed that Adam and Eve were our first parents, and through their sin, death entered into the world. But we know that death did not begin a few thousand years ago out in the Middle East someplace. It's been around for billions of years, death. And if we now move to the allegory, which if you want to move to the allegory, I'm all for it. I was listening to Sam Harris talk, or Alex O'Connor talk about Jordan Peterson and his metaphorical take on Adam and Eve. And it's just bonkers to me. But if it's metaphorical, then is the life and death of Jesus Christ metaphorical, or was it historical? Because Adam and Eve's sin, if the fall was metaphorical, then why did Christ have to literally exist and die for our sins? So it just seems to me like more evidence that this is man-made, and I just couldn't. The interesting thing about it is that for my doctoral dissertations, I read some of the most hard-boiled atheists around in philosophy, but they didn't really do much damage to my faith. It was actually listening to the debates online that Hitchens had. There, I walked away from some of those videos, and I thought, my God, I don't know how you really figure that one out. It just seems to me it's just, you just can't do it. And so I've taught courses on Hitchens, and that's been a lot of fun too, taking videos from his debates and, yeah, just showing them to my students and then talking about his various arguments against religious belief. And again, the classroom's full, because at my university, lots of courses on religion. You know, how come religion's so great? Why the Old Testament's so wonderful? Why Christianity's fabulous? You know, and that's fine. It's great to take courses in religion in university, but my course was one of the first courses that took a more skeptical approach to religious belief. And again, instantaneously, the classroom was full the first day, because people are really interested in this kind of stuff. Yeah, and it's too bad in Canada we just don't debate these things in our universities as much as we should, because we really should.
I must interrupt the proceedings and tell you that this podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. It's an all-in-one website platform. You probably have a business or a business idea, some talent you want to show off, maybe make money off of. Squarespace is a grotesquely easy way to get that all set up on the web. Show your work. Sell your work. I have many such products. I made my first webpage for my band in 1997. It's still up, marklint.com. It looks absolutely terrible. Any self-respecting new musician, new artist, should check out Squarespace. First, you want your website to look good. Squarespace has Blueprint AI, a website builder, to get you a fully custom website in just a few steps. They also have a complete library of premium quality, personalized design recommendations. Very easy to modify to show exactly what you want, where you want, and even AI content to write to the content of the page for you. So it's very hard to toot your own horn, to write your bio, to explain your product. Squarespace is going to help with that. And if you want to display audio, you want to display video, you want to sell either of these things, you want to sell physical products, maybe overseas, you want to sell your services, you want to have email campaigns to support all this selling, Squarespace has got all that. And of course, it's got analytics so you can see how everything's working, tutorials, and a help center to make sure you're getting the most out of your Squarespace subscription. Head to squarespace.com/Linsenmayer, that's LINSENMAYER, my last name, for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Linsenmayer to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
You know, when somebody is out in the quad saying, prove me wrong, I think, yeah, let's go. This is what we should be doing, because this is what the university does. My biggest complaint is against my colleagues who don't go out into the quad and say, hey, you know, I'm a molecular biologist. Let's talk about whether Adam and Eve were the first humans, or I'm a philosopher. Let's talk about arguments for belief in God. That's what we should be doing as professors. Anybody wants to come in the university and debate ideas, well, that's what we're here for. But unfortunately, we don't do that. My colleagues don't do that as often as they should. And that's, and sometimes universities are afraid to have these events because we depend so much now on philanthropy. You know, our universities are no longer funded by our governments, so we depend on philanthropists and rich corporations. And some philanthropists don't like some ideas being argued in university, and they will phone up the chancellor of the university and say, you want to bring in this person? I'm pulling out my $5,000. Yeah. You know, it's the old story. But, and I know there's lots of really good books on religion out there. Critiques of religious belief. I guess I just felt that I have a little bit of a niche because of my background as a believer, as a theologian as well, but as a philosopher. And it's one thing to be a critic of religious belief. If you're a Bertrand Russell, you were never really a religious believer, or a Richard Dawkins for the most part. But if you are somebody in the faith, so to speak, and you step out of that, you become much more of a target. You know, if one of the bishops in the conclave decided he was going to be an atheist tomorrow, that would cause havoc, much more havoc than any outside critic of Catholicism, let's say.
Elijah, this is God. I hear you've been having some unbelief recently and felt you should, you know, actually just get a first person. And I brought my ex, Mary, here. You know, it was just a one-time thing, but hey.
Yeah, we work together now. I'm just going to take some notes, if you don't mind.
So, you know, I understand that you need to just believe your senses. You need to actually experience things firsthand. So here I am. Just wanted to show myself, and maybe you could reverse all that nonsense you've been talking.
First of all, you know, is that really you, God? I mean, there's some really weird stuff going on right now.
He just got a haircut. I know he looks a little different. He went from like flowing out into space to just like a nice clean crew cut. So he does look a little different. I understand.
I mean, I like that you have retained the 1890s beard, but I move on with the times. I'm a more modern God, but out in the square, I can't fit in the square. So when they're saying debate, I you know, but over the internet is large enough that enough of my majesty can be, you know, a little bit at each of the various
not
servers
as tight
around.
Of a squeeze.
Yeah. But it seems like you are pointing out the fact that while most people think that you should just determine based on your experience, well, the framework that we approach an experience with will determine whether we accept something as legitimate evidence or not. So if you already are an unbeliever and the sky opens up as it currently is right here, and God peeks his head down, you will say, surely this is an optical illusion. Surely I'm insane. Surely I'm being deceived. Something like that. You would rule out in advance that God could just appear.
We stopped using LSD a while ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, God, no, I wouldn't do that, you know, personally. You know, I'm taking it at face value. You are who you say you are. It's good to approach skeptically.
I mean, don't you think it's rude? You say you believe who I mean, to disbelieve God, when God says something, isn't that kind of an insult to God? Shouldn't you be scared
God,
into
remember your
to
breathing.
Believing? Okay.
I'm God, just, remember your breathing techniques.
I
in through the nose,
I don't understand
out through the mouth,
this insolence.
In through the nose, out through the mouth.
It's Carl Sagan said something that was really interesting. He said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Oh, that's a good one.
So the fact that this is happening to me isn't like somebody coming up to me on the street and saying, I'm so-and-so. I was in your grade 5 class back in elementary. Do you remember me? Oh, well, maybe we were. Well, that's great. But when God appears to me, somebody says that they're God, and that's a fairly extraordinary claim. And I think that if God existed, he would want me, you would want me to make sure it truly is God, at least if the Bible is what you wrote, because in the Bible, God seems pretty, in the Old Testament especially, pretty intent on making sure that the people who believe in God are believing in the right God.
He can be a little bossy.
a little bossy. But you got to do stuff.
I mean, I didn't write it. I don't have physical hands. I mean, I inspired people. They interpreted it through their own weird epistemic viewpoints. So, you know, if they wanted to tack on things that they associated with authority figures, you know, I can't control what they wrote.
free will and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly.
Wonderful. Yeah. So how do you then say, well, what's the weird stuff and what's the stuff that you really wanted us to believe? How do you make us mortal humans make that decision? That's the problem I have.
Right. That's why you have a brain. That's why you have reason. You can figure out what is merely a metaphor. What is and meanings can change over time. They can rise as the culture needs a certain message. Then people will find that.
So if we need a little bit of slavery here, those little passages about slavery,
Yeah. I mean, some people, the times where people were just way too free. And I felt like, this was the time for them to see the slavery passages and run with that. But then, you know, that time mostly came to an end.
When did that time come to an end? Because
I'm curious when it did.
You haven't updated the Bible for the past 2,000 years. If you're a Latter-day Saint, it's been updated, but and that's fine, we can go from there. But if you're talking about the Christian tradition, you haven't really updated the Bible for the last 2,000 years. You haven't updated some of these values that were in there. So are you saying that the Catholic Church, Mary's old institution, they can update it because they have the magisterium and they have the Pope and they have kind of this direct line to you, as it were, who provides this updates? Is that the way it works?
Or? I mean, it sounds like you're having a very sort of originalist doctrine of, you know, what did the people, again, they were mostly ignorant savages that were actually writing these words. They were the best I could do at the time. I guess I could leak inspiration to various other writers and give something more modern. But I figure, you know, it's a flexible document. Human beings are smart. They recur and whatnot. They can interpret it in ways that are more positive. You know, the be nice to each other, that kind of thing, that it comes through pretty clearly.
Yeah, the being nice.
I thought the being nice to each other wasn't an option, God. I'm pretty sure. Hold on, let me check my notes. No, being nice to each other was a mandate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's funny in terms of the being nice to each other, how it's so obvious in the Bible, and yet it seems so unobvious throughout church history. The be nice to each other. So when the Protestants and the Catholics teed off just at the Reformation, what was going on there against each other? See, they both said that they were interpreting your Bible correctly, if not just interpreting your words correctly. Why the disconnect? Why the disagreement if it's so clear?
You see, the Catholics, they paid for the premium. You know, they collected they did the sale of indulgences. They had a little more cash to work with. So when they, used the bread did literally in its substance, if not in its properties, turn into the body of Christ. But the Protestants, they just had the cheap version and it just stayed a cracker. And that's really what the disagreement was about. They didn't realize they were on different tiers.
Yeah, but they didn't realize that. But how could they have, given your book that hadn't been really updated by you up to those 1,700 years that had passed, pretty well 1,600 years? You know, there's no real update. And, you know, the thing is, when you were giving all that great information in the Bible, why didn't you just toss out a few really helpful ones, like wash your hands before you eat, or, you know, just some basic science.
You got to pay extra for those. That's the premium plus subscription.
I mean, it sounds like you just want to have written the Bible yourself. All right, so this is me inspiring you. So maybe your next book, instead of get all this, you don't have to believe, you can put the helpful stuff in there, and you can say, this is what, I'm not going to have to, you know, I'm just here. It's injecting in your mind. I'm not going to explain all this line by line. I got a little better things to do, but, now you should be set up to spread the word, and, I'll give it my official stamp. I'll write a blurb for the back of the book if that's helpful.
Well, what would be more helpful is if you just appeared to everybody instead of just me, because in the history of religion, that never goes very well when somebody comes along and says, hey, you know what? God just talked to me, or one of his angels just talked to me, or some special person.
I mean, come on, guys. I'm living proof, right?
Yeah.
You came to see me and it kind of messed up my whole marriage and my whole life.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, I guess I shouldn't have just buried, you know, those tablets with Joseph, with the Mormon guy. And I said, only you can see the tablets. Don't show them to anybody else.
Sounds kind of lazy, God, if you ask me. It's a little lazy.
Yeah, an oversight, I would say. But yet you're supposed to be omniscient. Don't you see into the future what kind of chaos that was going to bring? And yet you decided, I'm going to go with the chaos. I'm not going to tell other people. I'm just going to try it with Joseph now instead of Moses, instead of the disciples.
He's noncommittal. That's his problem, is he's noncommittal and he thinks that polyamory is sustainable and he's just going around anywhere he wants. And that's why we didn't work out.
Oh, he's God. He can do whatever he wants.
I mean, I
wants,
prefer
right?
mysterious. Yeah, I mean, that's really what it comes down to is that, you know, if I decide that something is become bad, become good, I can just decide that.
God, is it mysterious or is it an avoidant attachment style?
I smite thee.
Oh, no. All right.
There it goes. Let's
get a new line, God. Get a new line.
The mask comes off.
Let's wrap
here's
up
the wrath
scene.
Of God.
See, do you see what I'm dealing with, Elijah? We're stuck, you know?
All that love that was just granted to humanity, it's coming from a great source, I see. Yeah. It's like, just don't piss him off and you'll be all right.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think I always had doubts as a young person. I was already miles out of the
scene. I was letting Elijah know because Elijah's new to the landscape that like, okay, we've transitioned from scene back into conversation.
Good. Thank you, Mary.
Yeah. I was raised religious, but in a very liberal church and encouraged to question, and that was all fine. There were roots out, as you say. But I was always surprised at my mother would say, that's not a very Christian thing to do.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean? Like, so you're saying that the Jewish people, which they're probably a more positive way of putting that is like, hey, we've been given the gift of these teachings of compassion. Why don't you follow that? As opposed to distinguishing it in an identitarian way that we have some answers that your Jewish friends over there do not have.
Yeah. There's different ways that you process religion. And if you've narrow it down to, let's say, Christianity and North American Christianity and progressive Christianity, it's understandable why people hold to their faith, so to speak. But for me, especially reading the more ardent critics of religious belief, I had to come to a place where I realized that this book is man-made. The stories in it are man-made. Some are beautiful, some are horrific, but it's man-made. And if I start there, then I can't be in a so-called progressive community of faith, so to speak, because there's just too many questions I have to come down to the question of, if there is a God who exists, how would this deity manifest itself? And I don't see world religions doing a very good job of what I would think the God of this universe would do. And it's interesting, too. You know, when we look at James Webb satellite pictures, when we think about the science that has been done, even in the last decade or two, we see that the universe is a place, whether at a quantum level or a macro level, it's just far, far beyond anything that our human imagination can even manage. And it makes sense why that's the case. Our brains didn't evolve to understand the great questions of the universe in terms of its origins and its structure and such. If there's a deity behind it all, what kind of entity would that deity be? Would it be doing the things that world religions say that he was doing in the past? Or would he be exhibiting a little bit more thoughtfulness and intelligence about where we are in this universe, right? I mean, if you knew nothing about where our solar system was, what it even was, when our Earth came to be, when life came to be, all of those questions, of course, the books of religion make a lot of sense. They were certain guidebooks in some respects for communities during those times. Helpful sometimes, not very helpful other times. But today, in light of what we know in the sciences, it seems to me that world religions just, they might be nice poetry, they're a good historical artifact of our human past, but to hold on to it the way that we do today, on the one hand, I find it fascinating, but it's something that I just can't manage.
Elijah, what would you say to someone who might be listening, thinking that this is like ardent blasphemy and is just aggressively against even entertaining the eloquent concepts that you're presenting? What would you say to someone like that?
Well, it depends on the context, I guess, but I have had lots of those conversations in university too. And usually I say, well, let's start at the beginning. I ask them, why do you believe in God? Right? Why do you believe in God? Now, you understand what I'm saying to be blasphemy.
Because I read Aquinas, The Five Ways, and I believe those arguments. This is just to say, when I, yes, 2011, when my other philosophy podcast, The Partially Examined Life, consider arguments for the existence of God, we had a believer on with us as a guest, just so we'd have some sort of balance. And he immediately said, before he even started, look, whether or not these arguments work are totally irrelevant to my faith. And I think this is a common response and why maybe the interest in them, because it's true that probably people, believers or not, don't necessarily look closely at these. You know, certainly they wouldn't even understand most versions of the ontological argument until you lay this out in detail. But the argument, like, there must have been a first thing. That first thing could be God. Well, what about the Big Bang? Well, who created the Big Bang? Well, but if God's the creator, then who created God? Like, just these sort of very fundamental things just point at that we are children playing with things that are much greater than we are. How could we possibly make sense of this? So the whole idea in religion, if these forces are so much bigger than we are and our foolish reason, then reason can't be the way that we either latch hold of it or let go of it. So I just want to live with faith. Stop bothering with me with these, I wouldn't say facts, because the ontological argument or the cosmological argument, these are not facts. These are abstract reasonings. So it just feels good for me to believe. It makes sense. It's worked out for me so far.
I talk about that in the book. At that point, you see, if you don't want to be bothered by any of this, that's fine. I won't bother you about it, right? It's when you start to bother other people about it. You know, when you go to other people and say, hey, you know, are you a believer yet? And they say, well, why should I be a believer? And then you tell them your reasons why. Well, now you're not keeping it to yourself anymore. And I think at that point, we should be asking you some questions that you need to think about. And one of the questions I'd ask you is you do realize, though, that you're not, the religious belief that you hold to is not the only religious belief in the world right now. Uh-huh. There's at least 3,000 other people in other religions who could say exactly the same thing you did. And yet, the details of your religious belief couldn't be more different than water and fire. You're all at various points contradicting each other. Edgar Sheffield Brightman said, any universe in which Roman Catholicism, Christian Science were true would be a madhouse. I forget which one, which three, but it is true. I mean, it's fine if you appeal to experience as a religious believer and you're a Latter-day Saint. And I tell a Latter-day Saint, you know, you've come to believe that God is real and the Book of Mormon is the word of God because you prayed about it and God gave you that burning in the bosom. There's no doubt you had an experience. I'm not doubting your experience at all. What the experience is, what's behind the experience is the other question, because I have a lot of Christian friends who would say exactly the same thing, but yet you and the Christian friend will disagree vehemently with each other about the particulars of your faith. So one of you is right, maybe both of you are wrong, but you both can't be right. You both can't be saying, hey, listen, it's my experience, I know God is real. If that's where you stop, that's fine. But if then you walk into the public square and say, because I have this experience, God told me that this behavior is morally reprehensible because that's what the Bible says, I'd say, well, now we have a problem, because we have people in other faiths who, using the same basis of experience, make claims about their religious books, and yet they're diametrically opposed with each other. Mormon theology or Latter-day Saint theology, Islamic theology, Jewish theology, Christian theology, it's all very, very different with the particulars. They do not agree with each other. And yet, if they all base it on just experience, how is the outsider supposed to determine who's right and who's wrong? Or maybe they're all wrong and the Buddhist is right. You see what the problem is? If you're approaching this on the basis of experience, the problem of religious pluralism, if there's a lot of other religions doing it and yet you all disagree, then how is the outsider supposed to determine whose experience is really connecting with the real?
So let me yes and you with some words from Rorty, who I studied about religion not too much longer than a year ago.
Wow.
That he objected, you know, so we have these modern attitudes of, well, I've got my belief, you got your belief, I'll just keep mine to myself. I won't insist that, you know, I might judge you for doing these things that I don't like according to my religious beliefs, but I'm not going to shove it down your throat and prevent you from doing it. We're all going to just, and Rorty said, that sort of siloing your own belief within your own head is insufficient, that we live in a public world. Reason, speech itself is a public thing. It makes use of public norms. So to do this correctly, we have to subject what we believe to reasoning, to our peers, and figure this all out together, that you can't be an independent reasoner. And in fact, you're not. You never would have come up with that goofy religion and those specific things if it was just you looking at your own experience independently. Obviously, you were brainwashed. You were indoctrinated at some point. And, you know, just so I often think, like, yeah, would you ever come up with this? If you say it's supported by experience, would you ever come up with this on your own just based on experience? Of course you would not.
Right. Yeah. And you could certainly go down that route, and Rorty would have been taking the Socratic position at that point. The unexamined life is not worth living. And we need to go out in the public square and talk about these ideas with each other. I have some friends who are very, very different in their thinking from me. And one of the things that I really take away from it is how much I learn. You know, they get me back to looking at certain issues that I just had to rethink, and I was re-educated, and it's highly valuable.
Hi, welcome to the brainwash. I'm so sorry to interrupt. I know you're just having a conversation with your friends in line. We just would love to get your order done. So if you look at the menu, the brainwashes that we currently have available, we have a light soak. You could also go with the, you know, those little fish that kind of like nibble at dead skin cells. We could do that for your brain, for any thoughts that no longer serve. We've got the brain sauna where you can just sweat any feelings out. And we also have the full brain purge if you're interested in that, the special today for $149.99.
Yeah.
Any questions about the brainwashes available? We got a long line. Gonna need to make a decision.
I mean, is there one specifically to just expunge any belief in astrology? I feel like this has been something that I was...
Oh, you're interested in the astrological prejudice washes.
I was raised in a very strict astrological tradition. And so I judge people if I see a Taurus. I'm like, oh, I hate Tauruses. You know, and I just feel like it's causing more trouble in my life than joy.
Yeah, we can just do a whole reset for you. Mm-hmm, but that's going to be a little bit more pricey, but that will remove all astrological prejudice, sexual inclinations, and any desire for inspiration whatsoever. So that is a disclaimer if you do decide to do the reset.
Removing sexual inclinations. What does that mean? Just because I really like Leos, and I'm not going to have the prejudice anymore, or just desire altogether.
I'm so sorry. If you would have read the paperwork, is that double bias standard, it's not included in the package. You're going to have to go next door to Bias R Us if you want to keep some things. And you don't get to hand pick. You choose your wash, you get your treatment, and thank you for your service, and you thank you for patronizing us.
Elijah, have you thought in washing free of all the religious stuff that you were saying was, you know, just from your childhood, that you might lose something more of yourself? You might lose your libido, you don't know when you open that door.
Elijah, I recommend, if you're not interested in partaking in any of our more invasive procedures, we have a nice eucalyptus brain spritz, which just gets a little refresher. It's just a kiss, just refreshing, if you're interested.
Yeah, I just can't improvise like you guys.
Oh, that's okay. We'll just sign you up for the eucalyptus spritz. That's all right. We'll give you a trial sample. Why don't you just take this home and you can spritz your brain in the comfort of your own home? I know it's a lot for people to, it's a lot. Thank you so much. Have a nice day.
If I had the full makeover, which I did, because when I went to school in California in 84, I moved out of Christian fundamentalism into a Lutheran evangelicalism really quickly within a span of a couple weeks. But in fact, it was a worldview that shifted at the age of 24 to one that was very different. And when you do that, you're left in a vacuum, and it's a very precarious place to be, no matter what worldview you're abandoning and moving into. But if it's, it could be political as well, obviously, instead of religious. But when you do have that makeover in your brain, that world, that shift, you are in a very, very vulnerable position. Fortunately, I had professors at that point who knew what I was going through. So they'd seen other students do that, and they gave me books, and I was able. I was in university at the time, so it's a great place to be when your worldview is shifting. But since that time, you're right, Mark. I mean, it's not like Lego pieces, though. The brain doesn't really work that way. You're the same person in many respects, but you're different, and you have beliefs now that are different. You never lose that memory of that worldview when you move out of it. It's still in your brain. It's still in your brain. And you remember in Star Trek, you guys are Trekkies, I would imagine.
Enough.
Yeah. Remember when Picard was taken by the Borg?
Correct.
And they were made into interlocutor. He was made into Locutus. The Enterprise got him back. And they disassembled all his mechanical wares, the Borg. And at the end of that episode, he's left in his captain's room, and he's just looking outside, out on the stars. And it's all quiet. But suddenly he hears the voices of the Borg in his mind. And I was watching that episode with my son a few years ago, and I thought, that's exactly how I feel right now. I still feel that way years later. It's never going to leave me. That belief was taught to me by my parents. They were good people. They were thoughtful people. They were well-meaning people. But those beliefs will never leave me. They're always going to be, it's like a room in your head. It's like a room that you, it's like a house that you grew up in when you were a kid. And once in a while, you go back in your mind to that old house and you walk in the door. Yeah, that's the way it was. And you're walking down these hallways. And then you say, well, that's enough of that. Back to the real world. It's kind of like that. You know, there is no wiping of those memories. You just carry it along with you, but and it coexists in some respects, not in a dominant way, hopefully, but it still coexists with your ongoing worldview that you're hopefully putting together still brick by brick each day.
Can I ask you, in teaching these older folks, do you find that they are, as one might expect, less flexible? They are very hardened. They've already done whatever growing they're going to do. Or I'm old enough. I don't care. I can reconsider things. Are they more flexible? Yeah. What are you finding if this is your approach with these older folks you're teaching in the current classes?
Well, the thing is they're taking the course because they know what the course is going to be about. I make it very clear in the course description what I'm going to do. So there's no surprises because I don't want religious people coming into the course and then feeling like, wow, this isn't what I signed up for. This is offensive. So they know when they come into the course what they're dealing with. And by and large, yeah, it's just so different. Some of them were never religious believers. Some of them have stories very similar to mine. From time to time, I do have religious believers in there, and I don't have too much success with them, I must say. It's not much success. And it's just, when Jehovah's Witnesses come to my door, like I said earlier, I love talking to such people because I love asking them questions and just looking at them and seeing how they're processing it. And usually when Jehovah's Witnesses come to my door, I usually can determine who the younger person is, who the person in training is, and I pay attention to them. And I ask them questions, which I think are very difficult questions for a religious believer. And I see some kind of life, you know, going on. I see some machinations going on. And I look at the older person or the person with more experience, so to speak, and there's nothing going on. I do find it amazing. Sometimes my students in my class, we will have these one-on-ones once in a while. And again, they're just not processing the logic like the other students can. We're not talking about theoretical issues. We're talking about basic logic, the law of contradiction. You know, you cannot have A and non-A simultaneously. My explanation of how religious experience doesn't really get us very far because of the fact that we live in a world with many different religions. They just can't grasp it. They just can't cogitate it, which I find at that point, it's fascinating, but of course, there's more to it than just logic at that point. There's psychological embeddedness there.
I find all of this so fascinating, and it's very interesting because before we started, I said to myself, I was like, Mary, your beliefs are not being attacked. Your faith is fine. Be kind, think critically, and be curious. And I wish that more people would operate under that modality of kindness and curiosity, knowing that if someone questions something, they are not attacking my foundation. I think it's important to have an open heart and an open mind and know that everyone has different beliefs, and just linking it back into like improvisation and acting is we are an amalgam of our stories. Like it all, you know, it all started like around the fire in storytelling. So it's important to be able to listen to what everyone has to say and refrain from judgment and allow yourself to be nourished by alternative beliefs.
Yeah, to be able to talk to each other, to speak to each other. Debates don't need to be vicious arguments. When I tell students, arguing is a virtue. If you think arguing is fighting, it's not. Arguing is presenting your reasons for why you believe such, and me doing the same. When we do it the way it should be done, it's the basis of civilization. It's how we've evolved in our society as far as we have. And the reasons why we de-evolve is when we are either we stop doing it or we're forced to stop doing it. You know, we get offended because of it. You know, in Canada, we've had our own problems. Years ago, we had universities, York University was, God bless them, but the students were stopping people like Ann Coulter from coming into the university. And I think that's just wrong. I think it's wrong. I think Ann Coulter should come into the university, and I would get somebody to try to debate her maybe after her talk. And if she didn't have time, I'd say, well, we're going to have a talk after Ann leaves, and we're going to have a discussion about why we agree and why we disagree. That's what the university is for. And you know, no matter how much I disagree with you. And the thing is, when we do talk to each other, we realize there is this humanness that we have with each other, right? There's such great value in it.
I feel like the connective tissue is we're all looking for a way to move through life.
Yes.
From a place of strength over fear. Because I look at these things, and one of my personal things, I think, like, if it harm none, let it be done. Like, great, you have that belief, I have this belief, you're not hurting me, I'm not hurting you, it's not for me to take your toy away. So I've really enjoyed this conversation and your insight, and you have such, like, a calm eloquence and grace about you. And you're like, who, me? What, me? So this has been really fascinating. It's been really lovely to chat with you. And you got my wheels turning.
Oh, thank you, Marianne. Thank you, Mark. This is wonderful.
I hope our listeners are, you know, their wheels are turning too.
You know, I try to think each day, you know, it's so important to learn as much as we can, you know, on mm-hmm. a daily basis, and to reach out and to talk to each other. You know, so often, just on a final note, yeah, we have friends often because we share so much in common and we have this great vibe and we love to do the same things. I would, you know, say to people, hey, try to go out and make friends with somebody who is completely on the other side from you. It's difficult, right? It's difficult. And you might need to take breaks and that, but talk to each other and then fact check yourself, and you will learn so much good things. Right? It's a great way of educating. Through debate, the history of the universities has been, we have public debates all the time because that's where knowledge breaks through. That's where truth breaks out of. The best way to understand a given topic is to have two people on opposite sides who are equally educated in that topic and let them go at each other, right? That's the best way to learn about something. So yeah, if you find that somebody's saying something that you really disagree with, well, then you should go talk to them about it.
And ask them about it. Learn more about it.
That's right.
All right. So it's Unbelieving God, A Skeptic's Guide. Folks can look it up or look at Elijah Dan with two N's.com. Thanks, Elijah. Thanks, Mary. Thanks, listeners.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Mary.
Thanks for joining us. I shall tell my soul. Bankrupt!
Bankrupt! Bankrupt! Thanks for listening to Philosophy vs. Improv. Get more at philosophyimprov.com. Support the show and get our supporter-exclusive post-game segments at patreon.com/philosophyimprov. This podcast is a member of the Partially Examined Life family of podcasts.